The February 12th, 2009 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development. Good morning to everyone. This is probably going to be a little bit different kind of hearing on a bill than we're usually accustomed to. And I'll explain that here in just a moment. But I'm going to gavel in a public hearing on House Bill 2398. The way we're going to proceed today, because this was a committee bill that the committee spent a part of a session and part of the interim designing, since that time the governor's office has undertaken many of the actions that that our committee was going to recommend in its bill. And in order for us to understand what has been done, what will be done, and what is left to be done, we have designed, committee staff actually has designed a chart. The left-hand column is an analysis of what the different portions of the bill do. Then the governor's, when the governor's office makes their presentation, we'll be able to put in the various boxes on those rows what has been already done or whatnot. That will leave a third column for us as a committee to write in needs further action or whatever. Hopefully that makes sense to everyone. And I'm going to ask those of you who testify to help us make this work, because it's going to be a lot easier, I think, at the end for us as a committee to decide what actions we need to pursue. And with that, Kevin, would you please give us a summary of the bill?
Thank you, Chair Witt. Members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2398. This essentially does provide some revisions with respect to local workforce investment boards, changing a little structure in how to proceed forward. Also provides for the implementation of a couple of new programs, one of which is a summer work program, as well as designing some measures as far as transition. Helps create some standards with respect to designing plans for the usage and maximization of returns on workforce development resources. I give a very brief encapsulation of the bill, and I would direct your attention, as Representative Witt said, before you is a what I would call a scorecard for your own notes, three pages, broken down by the applicable sections in the bill that are being amended. By my calculation, we have Section 2, Section 3, Section 4, and Section 5 as the pertinent sections that are going to be under discussion today. On the easel is the first section, Section 2. The language that is on the easel is the same essential language that is on your scorecard. Again, this is summary, just to put this into, I guess, what I would call digestible parts. If there are questions, obviously the bill is the authoritative source, but this is kind of my summary to try to keep it short and sweet. We're going to go through each of these. There are a total of three easel boards that will be up. Again, Section 3 is on a second board, and Section 4 and 5 will be on a separate board from that. We've got some assistance from Katie, who's going to be help us with kind of keeping track up above, so everyone, I guess, in the audience can pay attention or keep track as well. And I think that's the general a general kind of overview as we move forward. We do not have a fiscal statement at this point. However, it's my understanding that to the extent that there are questions concerning fiscal, that we have a member of the community colleges here who can at least speak generally, I believe, to potential fiscal issues that arise.
Thank you very much. And Kevin, if you would please just if you review for everyone
briefly the sections on the first column, please?
Yeah, it's not a problem. Representative or Chair Witt, representative members of the committee. The first section we're going to be doing, section two here, talks about some revisions, creating plans, and I'll use that throughout section two here, that discuss the plans that will discuss how better to use and, I guess, maximize returns on workforce dollars. And each of these respective sections go through and discuss that. The first, obviously, is the direction to devise a plan for the usage of resources. Second one will be a joint OWIB, which when I say OWIB, Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and LWIB, which I refer to as Local Workforce Investment Board, are directed to adopt standards, specific standards for the plan. Section or number four up here deals with the Employment Department requirements to provide data and technical support for the plan itself. And then the fifth component is that the Oregon Workforce Investment Board would be providing up to $100,000 grants to local workforce investment boards to develop these plans. And that would be section three. And if you'd like, I can kind of do this as we go to kind of summarize it each.
Okay.
So it's a little smaller digestible parts.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. All right. So Kevin will assist us as we are addressing specific sections and subsections of the bill. And we had a witness sheet sign up in the back. Everyone who's going to testify, if you haven't had an opportunity, it's very helpful to me if you make sure that you've signed in to testify. And with that, I'm going to call up first Norm Eder, please. Thank you, Norm. Welcome.
Our workforce system is already working.
That's right.
Thank you. If I may, real quick, we're actually making some copies of the scorecard that will be coming out. If people are interested, and that'll be put over here in a few minutes.
Thank you,
Chair Witt. Members of the committee, my name is Norm Eder. I'm Executive Director of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition. Thank you again for hearing this bill and for having and allowing us to speak to it. The bill before you is a framework for a set of specific actions. It meets the test of connecting clearly drawn and specific solutions to a problem we all know we must solve. Our nearly empty training pipeline to middle-skilled jobs. These are the very jobs that the Oregon Employment Division, several weeks ago, as they spoke to you, said are the highest demands in the state. I simply would hold up this spreadsheet, which is the Employment Division's work, and provides you and Oregon and Oregon policymakers with very clear targets. They've done a terrific piece of work, and it would be an excellent thing to guide the deliberations of this committee. HB 2398 is not meant to be a comprehensive workforce legislation, nor is it a bill about the manufacturing sector alone. It is a bill about the Oregon workforce and the way in which our system works, and a series of specific responses to making that system work better. It is a workforce bill that seeks to help Oregonians into and through the skills training pipeline to living wage jobs. The bill takes aim at a clearly defined target and proposes solutions that we know will work. In other words, HB 238 moves us from talk to action. This is exactly the kind of thing that Oregonians expect to see in the legislature's stimulus package and from this entire session as we face the economic crisis today. We know that there are lots of excellent ideas floating around to help us address the workforce challenges that we face. And we hope that the committee will invite people with good ideas to come forward and help shape this bill into an excellent piece of legislation that serves the interests of Oregonians. But like the items that have been suggested in the bill as it sits before you, the ideas must be specific, actionable, and in response to the problems we know we must solve if we are to fill the middle skills training pipeline. So in this spirit, let me turn to the elements of the bill. The problem. We know that young adults today consume information through a variety of new technologies and social networking. Youth marketeers understand this. We see it all around us. Yet when it comes to career opportunities, we use in this state and elsewhere traditional ways that our intended audience, youth and young adults, don't tune into. They barely notice. So it's time to do something different if we expect to excite the youth that we have targeted for these middle skills jobs and who would benefit from them about the training opportunities that are present. The solution. HB 2398 calls for a youth-oriented marketing and outreach activity, harnessing the power of the Internet to create social information that will reach and engage youth in ways that we are only just beginning to explore. Facebook, some of these you've heard of, some of them you haven't. Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, FriendFeed, and Plurk, the newest one I learned about yesterday, are just a few of the social networks out there that youth are tuning into. They've replaced newspapers and televisions. Advertising, traditional advertising, doesn't work anymore. And they're the places where youth acquire information from trusted sources.
Norm, would you hold up just for a second?
Can I just, for the sake of kind of following along, and I'm trying to keep track on the testimony as well, I believe that falls under probably Section 4. When you're discussing this, just for the ease of kind of following along in your presentation of the 35,000-foot view, next to each solution, if there is an applicable section in the bill, again, just so that we can keep a little better track, could you let us know about that before you get discuss the solution?
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm looking for your summary here of that point. The communications program is Section 4.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we need to begin to find youth where they live today, even if it's in a place in a room and an address we in this room can't locate. Problem. Many young adults resist advice, even very smart advice. At the same time, they lack many of the most basic skills to even apply for work. Mr. Christensen, that is section, I have to find it here.
Section 3?
Section 3. No. These are the transition centers. Section 4. Section 3, number 4. Excuse me. Okay? The solution we propose that is proposed in HB 2398 is to ask for the creation of short-term transition centers linked to WorkSource Oregon centers. These will leverage the enhanced assessments that WorkSource is currently doing and the counseling services that are provided through the public employment assistance system and couple those to short-term training curriculum. And the curriculum will be designed to create non-threatening teachable moments where a few essential skills can be taught to those looking for work. Counseling can be provided, and perhaps eyes open to training opportunities that can be presented by our public and private training organizations. Problem.
Norm, I'll tell you what. I know this is going to interrupt the flow of your presentation, and maybe afterwards you could just note in the margin of your testimony and then hand it into us which particular section that addresses, and that way it won't be so interruptive. Thanks.
Kevin and I didn't coordinate this.
Well, thank you.
Problem. We know that summer youth programs and opportunities are among the most effective ways to shape attitudes of youth towards work and career opportunities. But we've not always targeted these opportunities to high-demand, high-skill occupations. as represented on this list. Solution, create targeted summer youth programs that engage youth with middle-skill occupations and businesses and business clusters where these occupations are in high demand. Problem, our community colleges have shortage of qualified part-time instructors to teach classes to those pursuing middle-skilled occupations. Solution, create a common statewide one-day curriculum and certificate program to prepare those with the desire and necessary skills to become part-time college instructors. Create and maintain a database of those who are ready to teach, ready to move into the classroom, so that colleges can quickly find them when their classes fill up, as they have been doing across the state just this year. Problem. Our local workforce boards, who are charged with managing the workforce system at the on the ground through across the state, do not always have the ability to mobilize all of our public and private resources around regional or state training priorities, and I might add local priorities. They only control a fraction of the money that flows into our regions, and therefore that weakens their ability to create coordinated plans. Solution, we need to empower local boards to lead and implement these local plans approved by the state, ensuring that training funds are guided to the implemented plans. Problem, the public demands clear metrics to measure our success in filling the training pipeline. Solution, HB 2398 offers a well-understood set of metrics that, for the most part, are already collected. These can be enhanced and can be used to measure and manage our progress towards the goal of filling the training pipeline. HB 2398 contains ideas industry leaders and training professionals think and believe and know will be useful. And there are ideas that can be implemented immediately, even in the depths of a severe recession. We know the ideas in HB 2398 are not the only ideas that will come forward to you. We accept that there might even be better ideas. Let's find them together by challenging others to come forward with a similar level of specificity, not with solutions looking for problems or problems looking for solutions, but with problems linked to specific common sense solutions that will make a difference to Oregonians and our economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for Mr. Eder? Norm, I know that you were in your last solution, you were discussing metrics, mm-hmm. and could you flush that out for us a little bit, please?
The problem we're trying to solve is a problem of filling our pipeline, and if Northwest Pipe Company, which is a manufacturing company, a member of my coalition, were here, they would tell you how they measure flow through pipeline. They put a gauge on it. They measure what comes in, what gets lost during the transmission, and what comes out, and the quality of what comes out. And so, if our goal is to fill the pipeline, the measurements are enrollments, completions, the quality of those completions, the wage levels that people are receiving when they take their positions, and also business satisfaction with the employers that they're hiring. And I'll add one more that is a very interesting one. Many companies, even today in the depths of the recession, have problems, and you'll hear about this today, filling many of these middle-skilled positions. And they go months with openings. One of the metrics we ought to apply is how long can we shorten that amount of time that it takes to find a qualified employee with these skills. That would be a pretty good indicator of whether or not our pipeline is delivering both the quantity and quality of people that our companies need.
Very good. And I also have, I'd like you to expound, please, a little bit on the notion of transition centers.
Well, if I may speak personally, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have a young nephew who is 20 years old and who barely made it through high school, and is now and has no appreciable skills that any of us can identify, let alone a job. I don't imagine this is an unusual family story. My nephew is an ideal candidate to move into the WorkSource system, which has made enormous strides in its capabilities and what it's delivering. But at the same time, it would be useful for him to have a short, standardized curriculum, giving him the kind of necessary soft skills, as well as perhaps a hard skill or two, that would be needed to even apply for a job. How do you conduct an interview? How do you fill out an application form? And a number of other things. And at the same time, I think the point is that this is a teachable moment. My nephew has made an effort to attend community college, but he hasn't done very well. And in fact, in the last two quarters, he hasn't completed a single class that he started. He doesn't want to be there, but there's significant family pressure for him to go. He doesn't want to be there. He's not listening to me, his cousins, his grandmother, his parents. So what we want to create is a teachable moment that is non-threatening, a moment where kids who, frankly, haven't decided they're ready for further training can still receive some training, some capabilities, and also some counseling and direction in a place that doesn't insist that they get a degree and without their parents and their uncles pushing them to become doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs.
And is these transition centers, are there locations that may be ideal? Would they be affiliated with other institutions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. We think that they should be strongly associated with the existing delivery system, which involves community colleges, the K-12 system, but linked solidly to the WorkSource system, which is the public system that is already has the capability of providing assessments and counseling. But we would like these, we envision these as being a more structured environment that are in fact linked securely to the community colleges, certainly to the community colleges, and perhaps other private trainers and training organizations as well.
Very good. Thank you very much. Representative Polvey, did you have?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to go backwards here just for a second, but Norm, I really appreciate all the work that you've been doing around this topic for a couple of years. I know that we've been talking about this. I don't know that the employment department nor I haven't seen the chart that you keep referring to, and it just dawned on me, I've had this conversation with the chair, and it may be a refinement that the employment department has come up with, but I had the employment department and the apprenticeship and training division work together to come up with a chart showing those metrics of, you know, the how many people we have employed in manufacturing and construction, the basic apprenticeship programs, and divided out throughout the industries. And it also shows the completion ratios and how many people, but it also has in it, you know, the projected demand for workers in the future going out to 2016, and I'm not sure I see that in your testimony, and I think that's an important element. Maybe it is in there, but I think it's important that we also look at, you know, where those high demand jobs are, and I know that it's probably in here, and I'm just not wasn't paying attention close enough to your testimony as I was trying to read through this. But I think it's important that we note that, and I would suggest that the committee get a copy. I can't believe that the Employment Department, maybe it's so new we haven't gotten that chart, but it would be helpful for us to have that. And as well, I'd like, I apologize for not getting the chart that I have to the committee officially, and make sure that everybody has that as well, because I think that really speaks to your metrics.
Chair Witt, Representative Holvey, I apparently have it, and I'd be happy to give it to the committee assistant to make copies. And I absolutely agree. This, and I think they have published it, but when they gave it to me, it was in this form. It is, as you say, a terrific piece of work. It ought to be a guide to how we make investments. And we will have opportunities during this session to make investments in workforce training. There will be, I hear, and you all know better than I, that there may be a state stimulus package aimed at that may contain some training elements. There appears now that there will be some federal funding. It would certainly be helpful to use this information, Representative Holvey, that you were instrumental in creating, in causing to create, to help guide those investments. I think it would be completely appropriate to do that. And it is exactly as you described. The Employment Department has identified, they began with, I think it was over 500 occupation categories. They narrowed it down to some, on this list, the last number is 269, just to reference it. The number one, and then they rank them with a number of metrics. Registered nurses is number one. Welders, cutters, solderers, and braziers are number two on the list. In my testimony last week, I noted that 10 of the top 25 are skills that you would find in most manufacturing, any mid-sized manufacturing company. So, indeed, I agree. This would be a very good way of helping to target investments.
Let's see. We have Representative Dembrough and then Vice Chair Huffman on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, and thank you again. I wonder if you could talk a little more about the shortage in the instructional workforce. Is the shortage that you're seeing a shortage that we're currently facing, or a shortage that you perceive we will face if we create these transition centers? And would the teaching skills for the instructors in these transition centers be different from the instructors who are currently teaching in the more, you know, the full-blown programs in the colleges?
Mm-hmm. Chair Witt, Representative Dembrough, let me take them in reverse order. The transition centers, I think, as they have been envisioned, are not a substitute, are not an alternative to a community college curriculum. They are exactly what you would expect a transition center to be. And as I described for my nephew Robert, with all due respect to the community colleges and the universities and even the high school, he didn't want to be there. And so these are designed and linked to the WorkSource Oregon system that I think can be bluntly described as a teachable moment for people who really aren't ready for much more than a moment, but that gives them a leg up and provides them with information as well as a few skills as well as assessments, which are, frankly, those assessments are being done in the system. I have to remember the reverse order of the questioning now. So the college instruction issue is we have brought forward these ideas as a package because the ultimate goal is to begin to refresh, to fill the middle skills training pipeline, which we all know has been dry for a long time. And as we have worked with our community colleges, and in particular, I will note Mount Hood Community College, although Portland Community College and Clackamas and Chemeketa and others have all been involved in this, but I have a specific example from Mount Hood. For 2 years running now, I have received phone calls from a dean at Mount Hood Community College at the beginning of the fall term saying, telling me that they've done such a great job of recreating a curriculum in the metals area that they're oversubscribed. They have too many students and not enough instructors. And the appeal has been, Norm, can you please send out an email to some of your employers and find out if they have people who would be willing to teach part-time who have these practical industry skills? So this item is is a very low cost, maybe no cost, idea that will in at one level stop the phone calls from coming to me and organize, frankly, what would be a very good problem, the problem of not having enough instructors because there's too much rising demand. If our goal is to fill the pipeline, we know there will be rising demand, and the colleges will need people from industry to teach. And so this is a very easy way of getting out ahead of that issue.
Mm-hmm. And if I could follow up.
Please.
And so is your sense from your conversations with industry representatives that they'd be willing to loan professionals to these transition programs, you know, give them time off to, you know, to get skilled up in teaching and then to actually be part of the program during the summers?
Representative Witt, or Chair Witt, Representative Dembro. This element of the bill is to add teaching capacity to the middle skills programs which are being taught in the community colleges. They really aren't the transition centers. But the answer to your question is absolutely yes. The other attribute to this proposal is that it involves industry very directly. You will have an opportunity today to hear from several representatives from industry, and one in particular, my longtime colleague, Eileen Drake, who is the Vice President for Human Resources at Precision Castparts. And not to steal her thunder, but I think she would tell you that her company would be absolutely delighted to work with the system in identifying people who have necessary skills and could be teaching in the community colleges, again, as part-time instructors.
Okay. I look forward to her testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Norm, I'll get to you in just a minute, Representative Esquivel. Norm, I was wondering, you had a reference here to certificate programs as part-time instructors at community colleges, and I'm wondering who the target group might be for those certificates.
Chair Witt, the folks who we would be retirees with skills or people still at work who have a desire and an interest to teach as part-time instructors. And this notion goes to is the idea of trying to, if you will, normalize a pool of talent that could be drawn upon on a statewide basis. And so this is, as I described it, it may be no more than a half day or a one day training program for an electrician or a carpenter or a welder or a machine tool operator who has a desire to teach part-time in a community college, maybe working, maybe retired, and that it is a way that they can be prepared to confront the classroom. Here's how you manage a blue book. Here's how you manage a classroom. Here's what a curriculum looks like. Here's what you have to do to turn grades in. It's not very complicated, but that you could issue them a certificate and then enter them into a statewide database that would be accessible by all of the institutions. So upon the need of where they do have a lot of demand and need to open up a new section, you simply could go to a database and you could find a machinist from Boeing and contact that person and say, by the way, how would you like to come in two nights a week and teach a new machining class for us?
Wonderful. Representative Esquivel.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. You actually answered kind of my question. I'm thinking of the second most demand is a welder. Yet there's the academic side of welding with penetration and things of this nature, the scientific part, but yet welding's an actual art where you may know how to weld from a book, but you don't know how to weld. And people that know how to weld may not necessarily know how to teach from a book. And I was wondering how you bridge that, because I've seen people that can weld that looks like a piece of metal has been there all the time. And then, of course, there's me. I stick the stick all the time. But anyway, I was wondering how you overcame that.
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I think
Machinists.
With whether it's machinists or a welder or a brazier or any of these other skills. Again, it is to harness the capacity of this state to begin to fill and to fill that middle skill pipeline. And each of these ideas, and again, I will repeat, I'm sure there are other ideas that will come forward which and some of them, and they might even be better. And that would be a really good thing. That's how you put together a effective piece of legislation. But we ask that they be practical, and I think each of the ideas we've put forward has meets the test of practicality. They can be implemented immediately, and will have a beneficial result.
I have Representative Holvey, followed by Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I seem to get hung up on some of these things, but I think one of the things that we have to, and I'd like you to comment on this, I guess, you know, I think we really have to have an idea what our goals are as far as, you know, in measuring the outcome of our efforts. And so when we're talking about the instructors or talking about the students or interns or whatever, it seems like one of the things, for example, in welding, you have to be able to pass a welding inspection. And so you have a pretty good criteria of what it takes to be a qualified welder, because you have to be able to weld to a certain standard. And in many of our jobs, you know, especially when we're aiming at that, there aren't really quantifiable standards all the time. But I think it's important that we work on, you know, having some sort of standard of what is necessary for the industry that we're trying to train for. And I think establishing those standards is extremely important in trying to measure, you know, that metrics of, you know, how are we doing? Are we getting there? Are we producing the workforce that industry really needs and that can do the job, you know, productively, you know, efficiently, I guess, you know. So I want you to comment on that. Is how do we go about all these different industries where we have a demand and we have, you know, nursing and has, you know, different standards, but it seems like we need to have a spreadsheet on the different standards that have to be met and to measure our success.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I couldn't agree more. We tend, when we, in our workforce, in fact, as we think about the education enterprise, we usually begin and end with the front end of enrollments and completions, and often we miss the qualitative side, which is, I think, your point of what exactly are we producing, and what are our graduates at all levels capable of doing. And so I think you make a good point. We certainly have been strong supporters as we look at the workforce, and I will add, by the way, that the community colleges have done a very good job of working, certainly with the manufacturing sector, and I believe other sectors as well, as to define what is expected in the workplace, and seeking to move their training and their curriculum to deliver those capabilities. And later on today, you'll be hearing from some workforce professionals who can speak to that directly. But I think there is another element to what we should be looking at that also, I think, is part of what you're driving at, and that is, what happens after they leave the training program? And are our businesses and our industries around the state satisfied with the quality of the folks that they're getting, with their skills? None of the companies, certainly that I represent, expect that the people they hire will be fully formed and trained to become masters of anything. Companies step in at that point and provide lots of training training which is specific to their own company and to their industry and to what they produce and how they make it and the machines they make it on. And you wouldn't expect it to be otherwise. But they do ask for a certain base level of competence and of capability, whatever the skill that they believe they're hiring. And they, and I think that we can measure, as part of measuring this pipeline, we can look at wage rates, we can look at the satisfaction of companies in terms of their hiring and their assessment of the quality of the people that they're getting in an analytical way as opposed to simply an anecdotal way, which is primarily what we do today. And by the way, I think we should also be looking at the satisfaction of those people who come out of the system and after they take their place whether it's the shop floor or the executive suite. It would be a very interesting question that 2 or 3 years out after somebody's been working to then ask them, so how well prepared do you think you were now having worked 3 or 4 years for whatever your skill level? And I think there would be some very interesting data that would come from that and would help us. The point of data is to help us improve the system. We shouldn't be afraid of what the data tells us. We should embrace it, and we should be improving the system every step along the way using data.
Thank you. A great answer.
Thank you. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Trying to nail down the elusive document. Norm, I don't know if you've seen a finished product, but is that the document with the data you've been working?
I think it is, but I haven't seen it. You're right.
Graham Slater did a lot of the work.
Indeed.
Okay. Graham presented this, I think, to our last web meeting. Anyway, the document is 5 copies. It's supposed to be hand-carried here, even as we speak, by the Employment Department, because for some reason we've had a hard time tracking this down. I don't know why I'm the only one with a copy, but I'm blessed. So, anyway.
And our vice chair is quick on his feet, too. So, thank you very much for that assistance. Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to the issue of instructors, I do want to say that many of the colleges, I think, already have programs in place to integrate professionals into the part-time teaching workforce, and I think you really want to tap into those as much as possible in this vision. You know, a half-a-day orientation really is no more than an orientation, and it's got to be a sort of entry point to something more substantial, including, I think, some serious mentoring of these new instructors. We have had a lot of experiences. I personally have had a lot of experiences of having to clean up the mess when some people who wanted to become teachers but really didn't have the inclination, the temperament, or the skills to do it. So it's really important that it be done right. I just wanted to make that point.
Chair Witt, Representative Dembrough, I couldn't agree more. As someone who has had a faculty post for 26 years at an institution of higher education in this state, I agree, and it would be a welcome refinement to this bill and to the language to add that. Again, I think our interest is constructing a practical, well-thought-out piece of legislation that serves the interests of Oregonians, and I want to emphasize practical. And so you raise a question that resonates from my own personal experience, and I think it would be a terrific addition.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, one other point. Going back to the transition centers, I think that if we do, eventually wind up with a system like that, I think what's really important is that the underlying focus of that experience be to develop the basic skills of the young people, that the practical real world work applications be used as a vehicle for working on their math skills and as well as their communication and small group skills, because that really is what's holding a lot of people back. So if you can do that as well as expose people to workforce opportunities and form partnerships with industry, then I think you will have accomplished a lot.
Chair Witt, Representative Dembrough, I think that is exactly the intent of these centers. WorkSource Oregon began doing widespread assessments, and there will be others today that can give you a little more detail on those. Certainly in the Portland area, in the fall, I believe October, and so we've tried to think of the things we've proposed as things which bridge, that fill gaps, that attempt to accentuate and strengthen the existing system. And so here we have millions of dollars which have been invested in WorkSource Oregon. They're doing these assessments. They're a fabulous tool. We can now strengthen those and accentuate those through these transition centers, which, again, as I would describe them, as a teachable moment in the fullest sense of the word.
Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Norm, again, I want to thank you ever so much for all of the assistance that you have lent this committee over the past couple of years. It's very much appreciated, and without you, I don't think that we would have been able to focus our attention on some of these very, very critical issues. So thank you from all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly appreciate it. Thank you very much. Yes, please. Vice Chair Huffman.
I would just like to thank the Employment Department for their responsiveness in hand-delivering these documents to the committee.
That is that is truly fast service. Thank you so much. And Vice Chair Huffman, thank you for facilitating that, too. Next, I'm going to call up from the governor's office, please, James Sager. And this is when we get into the charting. And if we get too deeply into it, we're going to start handing out dots. So, just kidding. So, James, thank you very much for coming today. And I will apologize in advance if trying to structure this towards our columns and rows makes your presentation difficult, but I certainly appreciate your trying to help us wade through this.
Sure. Well, Chair Witt, members of the committee, first for the record, James Sager with the governor's office. I've been sitting back there trying to kind of cut and paste and write notes to myself to make sure that I cover all the elements. But if I might, let me first start off just kind of with an overall statement from the governor. I'm sure all of you have heard him talk about the fact that for the last probably two decades, not just in Oregon but across this country, we've been sending the wrong message to our young people. That message being that you're only of value to us if you get a four-year university degree. And over that time, we have moved away from looking at the real jobs that are needed across this country and providing the training programs that young people need to be able to use their hands, to be able to really get in and build the roads and build the structures. As the governor says often, you know, yes, we need electrical engineers, but we need electricians. Many of us maybe even regret that we pursued our four-year degree path instead of getting in and having an opportunity to build and create. At the same time, the governor has also had a couple different groups looking at the fact that even as we continue to improve that traditional pipeline and provide greater opportunity for young people, if you look at the workforce of this state, the number of 12th graders that leave our K-12 system every year have virtually no impact on the workforce. It is the adults that are already in that system. And it is shocking that about 10% of Oregonians age 25 and above don't even have a high school diploma. The vast majority of those adults did not go through the Oregon K-12 system. They have moved to Oregon. And so we really have to look at this holistically, and that's why the governor has pushed so hard to have the education workforce system, pre-K-20 with the workforce system, integrate so that, in fact, we try to align these systems. With that kind of opening comment, let me try to follow the chart, and we can put some comments up there. So the first item is the workforce board and maximizing return on resources. First of all, let me say that, you know, we can be very proud in this state. We have not only a superb state workforce board, but we have top-notch local boards. These are businessmen and women, economists, community leaders, educators across the state that come together voluntarily to really do what's right for their area. The governor has directed that the state board and the local boards align their investment plans to focus on four primary areas: healthcare, manufacturing, green, clean tech jobs, and regional high-wage, high-demand jobs. Now, that's exactly the work that the document that Vice Chair Huffman brought in and that Graham Slater and his crew have been working on. Between the work that they've done and the work of the people in the field, we can now, basically down to the zip code, tell employers, you're looking for people with certain skill sets. Guess what? In this zip code, there are seven people that have that skill set, and we can identify who those are because we've had them enter their data into the iMatch system, and so that we can align it. Now, there are people out there who haven't entered into the system, but we have to continue to grow this. But we now have that ability, and also the ability to really focus. One of the problems in the past, rightly a concern raised, was when you just look at the macro level of what are the high-wage, high-demand jobs, that could very well reflect 99% of the metro areas, and so it doesn't have any relationship to a rural community. With what the work that Graham and his staff have done is be able to really focus down on each region. So it isn't the metro area saying we need 5,000 engineers. It can be Malheur County or Harney County, looking at what their economic base is and where their jobs and potential jobs are for the future. So decisions can be made locally by the local workforce boards and then supported by the state. So in trying to tie the first three boxes together, so there is alignment. The governor has directed this to be done. The work is in progress. We'll get to the timeline later in the chart. The letter has gone out to the local boards with the recommended standards, which is the second box. The state workforce board has looked at those standards, and now we're waiting for feedback from the local boards so that we have not only the alignment of the workforce priorities, but the standards around how we do that work. So that is also in the works. As I said, the employment department has developed this data and continue to expand their ability to provide us really top-notch data, including now doing a great deal of work to break down really what we mean by green or clean tech jobs, because they don't show up in the national coding of jobs, but we really need to see what that means for Oregon. So they are doing a wonderful job. Though the direction came from the state OWIP to the employment department, through the governor to the employment department, to do that kind of work, because the state board created the strategic plan, winning in the global marketplace, and began identifying what are those gaps in our system that need to be addressed. And this was clearly one, having that kind of local data. The fourth,
James, if I could just interrupt here so that we can kind of encapsulate this. The first item in the governor's action column might be labeled ongoing or something like that. How would we best characterize that?
Well, in trying to read the way it's kind of been captured here compared to the actual language of the bill, the local boards are already working and working with the partners identified.
It's
and the governor has directed that he's ordered the alignment, and the alignment is in those four key areas.
Okay, so alignment is ongoing, maybe something
correct.
Like that.
Sure.
If you would, Katie, please. And then
the standards around the plan, as I indicated, the standards have been, a draft of the standards have been developed.
Mm-hmm.
They're out in the field to the local boards for their feedback, and so that we can complete that process very soon.
Okay, very good. The second box, OWIB has outlined the program. There may be a better way to phrase that.
Yeah, they've drafted the standards.
Okay, OWIB has drafted the standards.
They're being reviewed.
And
being reviewed by whom?
Oh, good question. Vice Chair Huffman.
Jane, being reviewed by whom?
The local boards. We want to get their feedback on it.
And the third box, again, this is per OWIB's direction?
Correct. And so it's ongoing.
Ongoing
work.
Per OWIB's direction.
Correct.
Okay. And OWIB is OWIB, Katie. Oregon Workforce Investment Board is what that stands for.
Sorry, I should have made that clear.
OWIB.
OWIB, yes. And so the fourth box, provide the $100,000 grant. The monies that come through the system from the federal government, the Workforce Investment Act money, WIA, goes out to the locals, and they can use parts of those funds for the plan development. So that's already built into the system, that there are funds there for them to use for planning.
Okay, so this is built into the system would be a good way to characterize that one.
Okay. And I'll let
Vice Chair Huffman.
James, just quick question on up to $100,000 grants. Is that, you know, a portion of it you just mentioned is for plan development. Is part of it for plan implementation? What do we think the real cost for a local plan is going to be?
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Huffman, there are people behind me that are going to have far greater expertise on that kind of question than I do. But and I'll probably be corrected, but I believe 80 to 90% of the resources that come to the state go out through formula to the local workforce investment boards. Inside those dollars, they submit their plan to the state board, and we'll get to that a little later in the charts here. To say how they're going to use those dollars. Those dollars go out through formula. And so they have resources in the system to say, you know, to do the planning and to develop those plans. But I don't have even a ballpark number that I could give you.
Thank you. And before you proceed, Kevin reminds me, just out of concern for the public process, that the notations that we're making are simply that, notations to make it easier for us as a committee to be able to digest this. The printed bill itself is what guides all of us on what our considerations as a committee are. Thank you, Kevin. Okay, if you please proceed.
Sure. So, Chair Witt and members of the committee, if you flip the chart over, the first item, I say over because that's what my sheet is. is the summer work program. The local boards and the state board advocated to the governor the creation of a state-funded summer employment program. But even at the time of the November revenue forecast, the governor could not find the resources, the state resources, to support the program. Luckily, it is a part of the federal stimulus plan. And so, in fact, It appears Oregon may get $10 to $12 million for this activity, and so we will follow. We will implement a summer work program using federal money, following the federal guidelines, and so and we believe that it aligns well with all the thinking that has gone on in the past to develop the proposal that that could not be supported by the state budget.
Representative Polvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, when you say that we're going to develop a state-funded program, I assume that we would be potentially supplementing existing programs that are out there. This committee's seen a wide range of from nonprofits to private to public programs that are already in existence. So are you talking about creating a new program, or are you talking about beefing up the programs that are in existence, or maybe both? I don't know.
Chair Witt, Representative Holby, the answer is yes.
Damn it, that wasn't really what I was looking for.
Well, you know, when you give
didn't
me
know
that
how to react to that one.
Now you are sounding like together.
Let me rephrase the question.
Representative Holby, no, the idea, we have a number of great ideas on both expanding, as you say, expanding current programs that continue to operate, as well as creating new ones so that we can expand the opportunity for young people across this state. The proposal had come forward that the state of Oregon submit about between $10 to $12 million into this expansion and development. But as I said, the governor couldn't find that in his budget proposal. Now we happen to have the opportunity to use federal monies, and we believe that we can move forward now on that planning, that expansion, and that development using federal dollars.
So please follow up.
Well, follow up. I just wanted to make the point that we have infrastructures out right there that are not very well funded that could do a lot more. And so instead of reinventing the wheel all the time, it seems like, you know, a focus would be to repair the wheels that we already have. But thank you.
You're absolutely correct, Representative Holty.
So maybe shorthand for this is we're anticipating federal dollars. Katie would be... I think we'll all know what that means, hopefully. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I
yes.
just follow up? So,
yes.
Jim, will we be hearing more about this proposed program? I mean, it went through an initial sort of vetting process within your department, right? You know, because I'm curious to, you know, at some point to hear more about what, now that it may actually have the funding to become right. reality, to hear more about it.
Chair Witt, Representative Denbro, absolutely. We'd be happy to come back, and once we know that the ink is dried on the president's document, and we know the money is going to flow, we will double check any federal requirements, and we can come back and share that with you.
Great. Thank you for that question, Representative Dumbro.
So that somewhat ties with the next box, and that is the data collection. There is regular data collection by the local boards, the state board, by the Community College Workforce Development Department, who really kind of gathers it all and keeps track of it. There'll be requirements based on the federal program that we will have to meet, as well as all of you, I'm sure, are well aware, both the state and even local communities or interested people add pieces that may actually be even more important to our decision-making process. And so we add those data pieces to the collection, and so that work will be ongoing.
Okay, so ongoing is probably a good way to characterize
it. Keyword
for
you, yes.
Thank you.
If I might, on the next one, if I could just take a few moments here to expand upon what Norm was talking about with the transition centers and what's been going on. We have a number of very good examples around the state where we have both public-private partnerships. I'm thinking of the ACE Academy out in northeast Portland. Norm was talking about his nephew. My nephew goes to the ACE Academy 2 days a week as part of his senior year at Park Rose, and I think he's finally found his potential niche in life. He's doing a marvelous job out there. We have the Cal Center over in Gresham. We have the Technology Center in Canby. There are programs that tie the high schools directly into workforce connections and potential career connections. We have manufacturing core certificate that the community colleges have been developing so that we can provide an education program that provides Oregonians with the core skill sets that they need that goes across manufacturing industries that all recognizes what our workforce needs, and then, as Norm said, they can have the on-the-job training to actually meet the requirements of that that business. We have the career readiness certificate that I'm sure a number of you have heard about, and if I might, I could back up a little bit on that. All of our the employment department and community colleges and workforce development have worked for several months now to coordinate kind of the front-end delivery any Oregonian going into any of our centers to where they go through an assessment. And that assessment can be really that teachable moment. Because if a person, meets the expectations of the initial assessment, then we can talk about doors open to them. If they don't demonstrate that they have the really basic skill sets, we have a series of options that people can pursue. Here's an online program that you can use. Here are community college classes you can go to or other community classes in order to get the skill sets necessary. And these are really basic skills necessary to really pursue a job that may have a career pathway for you as opposed to a job that's going to be there for 90 days and then disappear on you. That kind of pre-assessment piece works well into the career readiness certificate where, again, we can put potential employees through the assessment and they come out with either a bronze, silver, or gold certificate. And that will tell them and a prospective employer that this person has the skill sets necessary for these kinds of jobs. And this has been matched to, I think it's over 20,000 jobs nationwide, careers nationwide. And so this is an industry-recognized set of standards. But what is important here is that the CRC is not designed just for that low-skilled person. So the man or woman who's been working 20 years in a mill, and that's all they've known, and now the mill closes down, and they don't have a clue how their skills translate to something else. They can go through this and we can help them and we can direct them to, again, industries, job opportunities that match their skill sets, not their specific background of work. We also have companies that are doing it internally. So people that want to be promoted or move from one division to another, they would go through this again so the employer could see, yeah, my employee's ready to move over to this other division. So it's a very dynamic program. And just as an example, recently we had an Oregon company close by here. They had 8 openings. They had hundreds of people apply, of course. And we put a pool of the applicants through the assessment process, and the company chose about 100 people out of that pool to kind of do some sorting and interviewing. The company came back and said not only did they have the best pool of applicants they've ever had, but the 8 people they ended up hiring were the best 8 hires that they've had in a very long time. Because, again, we, the state, and the system helped them do some filtering before they actually interviewed, and then they got the right people that, again, had the skill sets for those jobs. So that kind of coordination is really taking off. It is a program that, again, the governor has proposed in his budget, and whether we get state money or we can figure out a way to use federal money, this is something that the governor is very committed to take statewide. The other piece that I need to comment on are the career pathways, which the community colleges have done a marvelous job of creating, so that, again, it isn't a person saying, oh my gosh, I have to give up 2 years of my life to go to community college to get a 2-year associate's degree. They can go for short periods of time, get very specific training so that they can keep their job, or they can get a job, or stay with their employer and help make the employer more competitive. But that certificate ties to another certificate, which ties to another certificate, which in the end can lead to a 2-year degree. So you don't have to go the full 2 years. You don't have to complete the AA. You can target what your completion is based upon what your need is. And so aligning that kind of need and program has been, I think, a major boost for opportunity for Oregonians. And again, this is a great job the community colleges have done. So I just wanted to highlight those as they relate to this idea, this transition. I think we're doing a lot of those component pieces in the programs that I've tried to highlight.
So our shorthand might be several programs operational or operating or something like that, and I can assure you that Kevin's taking very copious notes here. And
I'm glad he is.
Yeah, I can read it later on. That's another issue.
News at 11.
Okay. Am I smarter than a fifth grader?
You can read my writing.
Would you like me to
please
continue? Okay.
Continue.
The curriculum and to train teachers, I think having a database of people that are willing and able to step up is great. In talking with community colleges, the need or the shortage perspective differs. We know, for instance, in the nursing area, we're chronically short of qualified people to teach in the nursing programs. But in many of the other areas, again, depending upon the community college, and maybe they have created their own kind of pool that they can go to, many of the community colleges are finding it that they're having a great deal of success when they've identified a program that's needed, finding people in the industry that can come in and teach the programs. What we have to remember is that teaching a certificate class or a non-degree, a non-credit class, the person isn't required to have a master's degree. If they are teaching a class that is a credit for credit class and could lead to a degree, then the accrediting requirements are that the person must have a master's degree. So that is a challenge at times. But again, looking at workforce training opportunities, that connection with industry and being able to pull people in on a part-time basis or evening, utilizing or retirees that can come in and utilize their expertise, again, it may depend upon the community colleges as to where there are shortages, but expanding the list of possible people willing to do this and with the identified background, that that makes a great deal of sense.
And so maybe shorthand, willing partners or...
Yeah.
Okay. Would
perfect.
Would explain that. Thank you.
Appreciate you shortening my... section 4 is what I have written here, and it talks about a communication plan. In fact, again, the OWIB Youth and Education and the Communication Committee of the OWIB have been developing a communication plan very similar to what is suggested in this legislation. The first phase of the plan was to create the framework, the artwork, make sure that the feel of the website and the marketing tools were things that may not resonate with me, but they'll resonate with 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, which is a whole different methodology and approach. And we have created what's called mypathcareers.org. That's the website, to really bring that outreach and that connection. If you go to it, again, I'm not sure if it'll be your cup of tea, but we know from the feedback we've received that it resonates with the younger community. We're in the process right now, and the target date is to be done by July, developing the deeper content and the connections that have been suggested here. In other words, connecting to other nonprofits, other programs out there, so that way we can have this be a very dynamic place where young people can go to it, and it doesn't matter whether it's a community college program, private not-for-profit, you name it. If it's here in Oregon, they should have access to know those connections. And then in July, then the plan is to do the final testing, get the ads placed, and really start the active campaign of this program. So again, the OWIB directed it. It's there, and we're just now putting the finishing touches on it.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Just to follow up on something that Representative Holvey asked the other day, and I met with Greg White, our director, and to make sure that this mycareerspath.org and .com, I believe it's going to be available on both, but to make sure that we were really embracing OYCC and NWCC and the youth organizations and just, you know, those that would be targeted at the 15 to 23, 16 to 22 type of a category, to make sure that all these links were crossed in that. And Greg commented to me that, yes, that work is top priority for this website.
Okay, so maybe we could characterize this one as a forthcoming program per OWIB? Okay.
The next item, again, talks about data collection. The Community College Workforce Department already collects a lot of the data that is identified here. Some of it would be duplicative if we had another agency or another group at it. Some of them are some great ideas, but again, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the data that we collect are either required by state or federal requirements, or either legislators or business leaders or community leaders or members of the program have said, you know, we really need to keep track of this subset in order to give us the right data to make decisions. So, again, it's kind of an ever-expanding, ever-evolving list of data points.
So I think just ongoing is probably, yeah.
So Section 5, the standards be published. As I indicated, we already have the standards out for review from the field. So by March 1 of this year, those standards will be ready and published. Item 2, the local workforce plan submitted. We have instructed the local boards that we want their plan, and this would be a plan that starts July 1 and then moves through the next year. We want their plan submitted to the state, the executive committee of the state board by April 1. So the executive committee will review those plans, will give feedback, either great, you really hit the mark, or we have questions, or wow, you really missed the mark, so that if any changes need to be made to the plan, they can be reviewed again in May, and the plans then will go to the full state board in June for approval, so that July 1, when the money comes through from the federal government, that's the annual cycle, the plans will be ready to move.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. James, maybe I missed a point or something. On our paper here, we've got 2010 for plans to be submitted. Are we talking 2010 or are we talking 2009?
Well, Chair Witt, Representative Huffman, the legislation talked about 2010. I'm letting you know that we're doing it right now.
Okay.
So it's 2009 that this is being implemented.
James, on that, when those plans come out, if our committee desired, could we have a presentation?
Absolutely.
Great.
Sure.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
The last item on the bottom of that page, and I believe we're coming to a close here, talks about managing state, federal workforce development resources. Not quite sure what all is meant there.
Okay.
the boards, the local boards, are to have representatives from all the different sectors. As I'm sure all of you are well aware, oftentimes both state and federal money has a lot of strings attached, and you can only use this dollar for this kind of student or this kind of Oregonian, and so alignment sometimes looks pretty crazy. But between the work of the state OWIB board, what we call the Workforce Policy Cabinet, which is the governor's cabinet of all the people from all the key agencies that have any connection with workforce, we meet on a monthly basis, and then the efforts of the local boards try to coordinate those dollars. But there are also other recipients of state and federal dollars that we cannot necessarily dictate must do something, but in fact what we've tried to do is encourage and show that there is added value by their participation.
Thank you very much. So again, for shorthand purposes, under Section 5, our first box sounds like it's a forthcoming program.
Correct.
The second one, I think, is forthcoming.
Yes.
And I don't want to get too far ahead here. And then the last one, coordination where possible, or applicable, or however we want to phrase that. Committee members, I would like to keep the questions to a minimum if possible, because we have a number of folks here to testify today, and I need to try and get them on. Are there any burning questions at this point? Representative Dembrough.
I just want to throw out a question, and you don't need to answer.
Okay.
But, you know, at some point I think it would be useful to have a conversation about how all of this aligns with the process of creating the new graduation requirements. You know, the ODs, and I mean, the state as a whole has gone through a process, and it strikes me that much of that process is directly applicable to what we're talking about now. And maybe the success of our reaching those new requirements is going to be tied to what we can do in this arena. But you don't need to go into that now.
But Chair Witt, Representative Dembrough, if I could have maybe a little more than 30 seconds. You're right on the mark. That is why there is such active coordination between not only the sectors of the education enterprise, but the workforce board. The workforce board, we have created not only active participation at the joint boards of education, but the chair of the workforce board sits regularly with us when we're going through budget and policy development. We are really trying to tie those pieces together.
James, I want to thank you very much again for appearing and for doing such a great presentation within the constraints. We invite you to come and talk to us, and then we tell you how you're going to do it. I apologize for that, but it's been exceedingly helpful to us. Thank you very much. And to the public, just to note that our shorthand is precisely that, shorthand, and where there are many areas that the governor or OWIB or whoever may be working on this, there may be several ideas where we could actually make some improvements, and that would be the intention of having our additional witnesses. Norm Eater, I'd like to call you up, and I know that you have with you a number of folks that would like to testify. If it's any help to you, and my apologies if we can't get everyone through today, if that's not possible, if there are some, Norm, who can't come back, we'll get those folks on first. I'm going to try and get as many people as time allows.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a half hour. Anybody need to leave right away, raise your hand, and I'll get you up first. Okay. We have, thank you very much.
To identify yourself, please.
Yeah, Norm Eater, Manufacturing 21 Coalition. We have several panels of folks representing statewide who would like to speak to this issue and the issues that have been raised. So first, Pat and Dan, we have... And they'll introduce themselves and properly.
Thank you.
So. Chairman Witt and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you this morning. My name is Patrick Davis, and I represent labor on the Oregon Workforce Alliance Board of Directors. The Oregon Workforce Alliance is the local workforce investment board for most of rural Oregon. I was appointed to represent labor on an earlier version of this board of directors in 1983. At that time, I was the business manager for the United Brotherhood of Carpenters Union and covered most of Eastern Oregon. I have a long history of training people for work in some of the most out-of-the-way places in rural parts of the state, and I'm here today to share some of my rural perspective regarding the establishment of training policy. It's important to remember, as public policy is formed regarding training, that the ability to provide that training close to the where the people live is a priority. There was an article in the Oregonian on February 9th with the headline, "Wind Power Jobs Are Abundant, But Training Is Scarce." That article details the need for skilled wind turbine technicians and places the number at between 500 and 600 folks that will be needed over the next 4 years. The article also explains that the Columbia Gorge Community College program that trains wind turbine technicians will not be able to train nearly enough people to fill all those positions. These jobs pay between $23 and $33 per hour. I live in an area that's rural enough that if the Oregonian's delivered, it's actually an afternoon newspaper. And so I go ahead and get it online. The online aspect of the Oregonian lets me also read comments about the article that other readers have made in real time. And the following is one of those comments, and I quote, "The state needs to fund a program in the Portland area. I'd do the wind tech program if I could, but I doubt I could get decent work in the Dalles while I go to school. They just need to offer the training at PCC, Hood River CC, or Clackamas CC." End quote. The person that made that comment happened to be from Portland, but he could have been a worker hoping to upgrade his skills from LeGrand or Fossil or Burns. The thought that I want to share is that the training needs to be provided locally and that the training delivery system needs to work equally well in Portland as it does in LeGrand or as in Fossil. During the 1990s, I partnered in a school-to-work project with Pendleton High School. For a few hours a day, the students were allowed to work on construction projects and were mentored with journeyman craftsmen. It was inspiring to see the development of these young people as they experienced, most of them for the first time, the world of work, and how they progressed with the help of a master journeyman at their side. The concept of this bill of tapping into the local community reservoir of skill to help youth transition into meaningful work is good policy. I will be teaching a non-credit class in woodworking at Columbia Gorge Community College during the spring term, so I should disclose a certain bias in favor of this concept. I have worked with the Oregon Consortium and the Oregon Workforce Alliance for over 25 years and have witnessed it grow from into one of the best worker service and job training delivery systems in the nation. I'm sure that we can all work together to develop public policy that enhances the ability of the workforce system to produce ready-to-hire workers and businesses that are ready to hire them. And thank you again for this opportunity to visit with you this morning.
Thank you very much, Pat. And Wamek, Oregon, is well represented this morning. In addition to his credentials as a carpenter and whatnot, Pat also holds the distinction of, in his back 40, having the Barlow Trail. The Barlow, yeah. Right? Barlow Trail begins in your back pasture. So welcome, and thank you so much, Pat. I certainly appreciate your being here today. Sir.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Dan D'Acremont, a member of the coalition.
Can you just get the mic over just a little bit?
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Thank you. A member of the Manufacturing 21 Coalition. I've worked at Lyle International Companies for over 30 years. Lyle is a transportation company headquartered in Tigard, Oregon. We are a woman-owned business and have over 10 offices throughout Oregon and Washington. We support the efforts of HB 23. We believe there's a real opportunity for short-term and long-term career paths. We hope those that are in the career paths choose the manufacturing industry or transportation industry. We can do this by providing a clear roadmap and a step-by-step guidelines that motivate towards a continuous learning environment. With that thought in mind, we at Lyle have a real-life example of a person that actually needed this type of help. And I'm going to call him Jake. Jake is, I'm going to say, close to 19, 20 years old. And he came to us last summer, and basically said that he couldn't read or write. We understood that going into it. And he was in the warehouse. We asked him if he was willing to take some courses. With that in mind, Jake said absolutely that he needed some help. So we worked with Clackamas College. I called somebody up in Clackamas College, and they gave us a lead to where to move Jake to. So they did an assessment with Jake, understanding that he had a mild form of dyslexia. That he needed to learn to read and write is the basic point here. Jake has been taking courses. His confidence has changed dramatically. He's improving his reading and writing. And he has a career path goal at this particular moment, which is to become a CDL, commercial driver's license driver, and become a lead person with Lyle. The career path thinking, in my mind, is one of the things that this bill would really help kids like Jake, kids that need help in becoming adults that help create jobs for good living and have the opportunity to build their careers. I believe that there's a lot of Jakes in the world that are actually out there, and how we find them and how we direct them is really one of the key elements that we need to look at, and how we actually develop a career path for kids so that they can actually understand it. A lot of times kids don't understand a career path, what it really means, and how to get there. So leading them is very important. This committee and your colleagues throughout the building have an opportunity to make a real difference for guys like Jake. Lyle and others who want a strong Oregon economy believe that HB 2398 is a great start, and I urge you to support this. Thank you for your time today and your commitment in creating promising career paths for Oregonians.
Thank you very much. Certainly appreciate that, Dan. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Was Jake a high school dropout, or was Jake a high school graduate?
He did not graduate from high school.
So we lost him somewhere in the system, and he exited the system.
Correct. And as what happened is they assessed him at actually elementary level when he went back into for the assessment, and he's going after his GED.
Mr. Chair, can I
yes.
just say
Dan,
I just want to applaud you for the support that you're giving to this worker. I think it's great and really important for someone who has dropped out of the system to be encouraged and supported in getting back into the system. I really applaud that.
Mr. Jamal-Tamat, you have saved one individual. Good job. Thank you both so very, very much for coming here today. Certainly appreciate it. My apologies for being so brief, but we're going to try and get as many folks as we can on. Anyone who can summarize their testimony, it would be extremely helpful so that we could give a couple minutes more to some other people.
I'll go first. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Witt and representatives of the committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Chris Latimer. I'm executive director of the Oregon Workforce Alliance and the Oregon Consortium. We are basically the Workforce Investment Board serving all of rural Oregon. And I have to give you some background on the organization so that you can grasp the scope of what we're responsible for. Our Workforce Investment Board oversees the rural workforce system in every county east of the Cascades, all of the northern coastal counties, and the southern Oregon coastal counties. So we encompass about 80,000 square miles in 24 of Oregon's 36 counties.
My goodness.
We've been in business for over 25 years, and during that time we've delivered over $200 million in federal funding to rural citizens and rural programs. The rural communities we serve have been struggling economically for more than a decade, and they are now awash in layoffs and plant and business closures. At last report, this is what is really alarming to me, at last report we did have a low of 6.4% in Gilliam County for unemployment, but you have to think of the population of Gilliam County, right? But then in Grant County, where John Day is, we have a unemployment rate of 16%. 16% of our citizens in Grant County are currently without jobs. And this is just only going to continue to get worse. According to experts across Oregon and around the country, rural areas lag behind and will continue to lag behind their sister cities and more urban counterparts, not only due to their dependence on agriculture and natural resource-based economies, but due to the lack of human capital in our rural communities. Smart people live where smart people live, or smart people move to where smart people are, and business and industry looks for the human capital to support its growth. The lack of human capital translates to dwindling pipeline, a pipeline that we need desperately during this downturn to fill the capacity with workers ready to work in the industries of today and tomorrow, industries that we may have never had in Oregon, let alone rural Oregon before. Let's face it, our timber industry on the east side of our state is probably not coming back. When those mills closed down in the last 6 months, they left. We also have manufacturing plants that left Oregon, and they're not going to come back. Right now, the Oregon Consortium is managing 4 national emergency grants for layoffs. We have 2 more that we just heard yesterday are going to receive approval. We have 2 more in the pipeline. So, you know, millions of dollars in federal funding coming to assist dislocated workers. My concern is what job are those dislocated workers in rural Oregon going to go to? Our economic base has gone. And so what I'm working with my Workforce Investment Board to do is to take advantage of the crisis that we have. While we have workers who are dislocated or they've been downsized and they're working part-time just to keep a job, let's take advantage of the opportunity to increase our human capital in rural Oregon, and let's attract some new business and industry to our community so that we have a future. I don't want to oversee the formation of ghost towns in rural Oregon in the next 10 years. So, HB
20. Chris, if I could interject just for a minute, Representative Huffman has a question, I think.
Chris, thank you. Before you get too far along, I just wanted to point out that on the House floor the other day, I think Representative Galizio represented Grant County fairly accurately when he said the effective or real unemployment rate is probably close to 25% because of the way those numbers are calculated, and with mills being shut down for a long period of time, some of those are no longer counted in that. So just to give the real perspective of what's going on out in areas in eastern Oregon such as Grant County. So
I appreciate that. We do have a lot of discouraged workers out there who have just given up. given up hope and they're writing it out. There are several examples that, I'm trying to be quick, so in HB 2398 that I think could help us solve some of our issues in rural Oregon. First of all, the summer jobs component. This summer, we will deploy, as Mr. Sager stated, the Workforce Investment Boards will deploy the largest summer jobs program that we've seen in over a decade. My work, especially in youth work, goes way back to the days when we had huge summer opportunities for kids. As a result, young people across the area will gain exposure to the world of work and take part in career exploration that will help them to understand and achieve the skills necessary to be a positive part of the economic recovery. This is really important for our rural kids. I can't tell you what this means to our rural youth to have an opportunity to get some work experience and get some cash in their pockets. I'm hopeful that we will serve over 500 youth this summer alone in our 24 rural counties. It seems in some ways a pretty insignificant number, but when you think of the size of our programs and our population, that is a pretty significant number. And every one of those kids that gets a summer job will impact their family and their community in a positive way. So that grows exponentially. I also have to point out, this is a one-time investment. This is a federal stimulus that we're getting this summer alone. We don't know what our allocations will look like in the future, and if they're anything like they've been in the past, next summer we're going to go back to just being able to provide baseline services to kids, and that means, you know, maybe I'm running 200 youth in my summer program, but nowhere near what I'll be able to do this summer. So we really need to find a way to support summer experiences for kids in the long run. And getting to Pat Davis's point, we need to be able to provide training where people live. Some of my counties don't even have community colleges in the county. They're not even part of a district, a community college district. I need ways to get skilled trainers and educators out into rural communities so that we can, again, develop that human capital. So, I don't want to take any more of your time, but in conclusion, rural Oregon plans to move ahead during this period of crisis to develop a workforce ready to hire that others will be envious of. My hope is that all of us together can develop good public policy that supports our locally driven workforce system in deploying, convening, and leveraging resources that result in practical solutions to the problems we're facing today. So, I thank you for your time.
And we thank you for your testimony, Chris. Thank you very much.
Chair Whip, members of the committee, I'm Andrew McGough. I'm the exact opposite of Chris, although she does have a tougher job. I'm the executive director of Work Systems, which is the Workforce Investment Board for the City of Portland, Multnomah, and Washington counties. Thanks a lot for inviting me today. I guess I would be remiss if I didn't come with some statistics of my own, because I tend to like to do that, because I think it's important for us to look at the data and the information. And just to bring it home, we know that these are really tough, unprecedented economic times. But for every percentage uptick in unemployment in my region, it means that 12,000 people lose their jobs. Today, we have nearly 90,000 people unemployed in our region. That's nearly double the number that we had at this time last year. We have another 300,000 people that work full-time but can't support themselves or their families. We have tens of thousands of people in our region who read below the sixth grade level. These are adults that read below the sixth grade level and or speak a language other than English. 43% of the youth in our region, in our biggest public high school system, do not graduate on time with their class. And we have another 8,000 kids who are neither connected to school nor work. So I guess the point is, these are some pretty big problems. I'm appreciative that there are federal resources available to help solve these problems. But I think, as Winston Churchill said, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And we need to really think differently about how we deliver these services. Just to put it in perspective, we get about 11% from the federal government that they invested in 1970. Last year, the resources our region received to serve dislocated workers was cut by 25%. State funding, frankly, outside of the educational enterprise, is essentially non-existent for those adults that have these basic skills deficiencies. And local funding is drying up at record pace. So again, we've got some big issues. We have some opportunities, I think, with this stimulus package, and we think it'll provide some temporary relief. And as Chris mentioned, things like summer jobs programs, those are wonderful opportunities for youth in our region. And we think about things like high school completion. How do you relate that to new graduation requirements? How do you connect those activities up with high demand, high growth jobs in our community and make sure that there's a continuum of for kids to get served in the summer but also get served in school or transition to post-secondary education? And just real quickly on some of the specifics of the bill, we do help facilitate the development of federally defined plans in our region. What we need is some help to really create the threads and the connections to bring all of the partners to the table. And the other challenge that we have is, again, there are federal resources set aside for us to do these planning and coordinating activities, but as you all know, these dollars are really about serving people. And every dime that we divert to plan is a dollar we take from serving people, and that's a tough sell to my board of directors and the local elected officials and business community that I'm supposed to serve. So we do need some help to do the kinds of comprehensive planning, alignment, and coordination that I think we really need to coalesce around a vision for Oregon and delivery at the local level. So the other thing I might say is that we've been engaged from day one with Manufacturing 21 in other partners to develop a lot of the strategies that were designed outlined in this bill. There's imperfections in the language. I would be the first to admit that. But I think as strategies go, these were practical things that we thought if we did these would build on the existing system, it would complement local efforts, and it would really help us to move the system in a way that was measurable and accountable at multiple levels, from the state all the way down to the local level. And I guess just finally, you know, again, I think it's really important that we have these federal investments and we take advantage of them. But again, we have an opportunity here, I think, to think differently about how this stuff is delivered. And I can speak for my board and, frankly, for, I think, all of my colleagues across the state at the local board structure that we're ready to roll up our sleeves and work with you guys to figure out how to make this work. So thanks a lot. And
Andrew, thank you very much. Representative Dembro.
Thank you. I just actually you did touch on this, Andrew, but you know, the message that I'm hearing from both of you is that we need to figure out a way to take advantage of the stimulus package, but at the same time be thinking long term, right? Not create unreasonable expectations that are based on temporary money, but find a way to leverage that temporary money into something that's more sustainable. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
I think that in rural Oregon that we've hit on an issue that I think we all need to think about. And that is, once the jobs go away, we've been virtually locked out of our greatest resource we have in this state, which is trees. People talk about cutting budgets, cutting budgets, cutting budgets. Why aren't we cutting trees? You could do a 100-year sustainable forest plan in this state. You could go in, log everything that we've logged in the last 100 years, and have a sustainable 100-year plan. You would never touch a piece of old growth in anyone's life, and yet we would thrive. And yet we're locked out of that. I think it's a crime, and I think that we as people need to say enough's enough to the environmental community and quit letting the tail wag the dog in this state.
Additional questions or comments from the committee?
not hearing any. Thank you both so very, very much.
Thanks a lot.
Certainly appreciate your appearance today. Again, as folks come up, if it's possible for you to summarize your testimony, I've had a couple of my committee members agree to stay a few minutes late to be able to receive your comments. But at the moment that I lose we have to have a minimum of three of us, or at that point I have to, if I lose the three, then I have to shut the hearing down. So please proceed.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair.
Agnes, are you here today from Washington, D.C.? I hear there's late-breaking news in your career.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, I am now with an organization called the Workforce Alliance. I am their Western Regional Field Representative, uh-huh. and I am still stationed in Salem, Oregon.
Well, we're fortunate to have you. Welcome.
Which is a wonderful place to be. I'm going to keep my comments very brief in order to allow enough time for Eileen to speak. Part of the reason I'm here is the Workforce Alliance is the organization that coined the word middle-skill jobs. And you've heard that word tossed around several times throughout the conversation today. I'd like to take just a couple minutes to define what we mean by that before moving forward. The Workforce Alliance has been focusing on this issue of workforce development and training for well over 10 years now. Middle-skilled jobs is our way to capture that vast array of jobs that require something more than a high school diploma, yet something less than a four-year degree. So middle-skilled jobs are not necessarily, they're technical jobs in many cases. You know, you talked about the healthcare, the manufacturing, the green jobs. The middle-skilled jobs are the ones in all of those categories that don't necessarily require a four-year degree but require additional education. They're the same jobs that, from the governor's office, Jim Sager talked about us disinvesting in over the last 20 years or more. And so our focus has been in reigniting this conversation around these middle-skilled jobs. We'd like to applaud the fact that Manufacturing 21's bill focuses very clearly on middle-skilled jobs and has brought up that phrase over and over again to express what we're talking about. It's a place where I think it broadens the agenda beyond just manufacturing. It also allows us to include a lot of jobs that are very hard to outsource, jobs that in many cases are the core of our middle community. And we will shortly be coming out with a report focused on the fact that they make up about 48% of Oregon's economy. So they are those same jobs that you saw at the top of Graham's document speaking to where the need will be in the future. A couple things the bill does that I think is very, very strongly in alignment with that agenda. It focuses on helping youth understand the importance of those jobs. It also focuses on investments in training and education around the continuing expansion and capacity to train to those jobs. And so those are really critical pieces. I also want to comment on something that Norm said himself from the very beginning of this, is that it is not a comprehensive bill. It doesn't cover every possible solution. And in fact, without strong investments in other parts of the education and workforce development systems, it can't by itself solve every issue. But it does provide some actionable items. And as Norm has said, and as other members of others presenting have said, there's certainly room for figuring out exactly how to make it work most effectively. So we'd like to just go on record saying we'd like to see your support for additional work around this area of middle-skill jobs.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Drake. I'm Vice President, Administration and Legal Affairs for PCC Structurals, Inc., which is the Oregon-based business unit of Precision Cast Parts Corp. We still employ over 3,000 people in the state of Oregon, most of those in the Portland metropolitan area, but we have a small plant in Redmond, Oregon. And while it is true we have been doing some layoffs, and probably we'll see some more in our company, we are also still hiring, particularly for critical skilled positions, not just at the managerial and professional level, but in those middle skill jobs. And we are still having a difficult time finding the talent that we need in the state of Oregon. I'm going to depart from my written testimony and just talk about three areas in response to some of the comments that have been made this morning and some of the questions that have come up. First of all, Representative Dembrow asked a question about whether industry would participate in providing trainers for the community college programs aimed at the middle skill jobs, and the answer is absolutely yes. Not only do we have talented and skilled retirees who could serve in that capacity, but we also have active employees who are trained trainers. They have been trained not only in how to do skills training, but also trained in the job of being a trainer, and we would be most interested in sharing our resources with the community college because it is a benefit to us. The second area that I'd like to comment on is, because we haven't really talked about it very much, the value of middle-skill job from a dollar standpoint, from a what does it mean for the Oregon economy, and I'll use a personal example. Our younger son is 25. He's a graduate of the University of Oregon with a degree in history. He works for a large Portland law firm in a what they call a project staff position. So he has his college degree. He is highly skilled. He is highly intelligent. He is earning less than a first-year grinder earns in my company. And he has poorer benefits than that first-year grinder has with my company. In our company, three-quarters of our employees hold middle-skill jobs, and the average hourly wage is over $19. And we pay a quarterly cash bonus that for the last several years has been paying out well above 10% of the employees' quarterly total paid income, base pay, overtime, and paid time off is calculated into the bonus program. And we still have a pension plan. We still have an employer match on the 401k plan, as well as generous medical, dental, life insurance, and disability benefits for our employees. So when you talk about the value of middle skill jobs, these are very valuable jobs. We have hourly employees who, with overtime and bonus, have been earning over $100,000 a year. Not counting their benefits, that's their wages, their take-home wages. So we cannot underestimate the importance of these middle-skill jobs to the Oregon economy. The final area that I would like to talk about are the comments that Mr. Sager made this morning. And I have a great deal of respect for the governor and his workforce agenda and his manufacturing strategy and for the work that's being done at the OWIB level. We have seen tremendous improvements over the last several years. But on the business side, we also continue to see a huge disconnect between that strategy, between the work of the OWIB, and what is actually available to us through the local workforce investment boards and through the community colleges. And let us not continue to make the mistake of confusing laudable goals with actual concrete action plans that get results. I'll give you two examples here. The talk about the youth communication plan under OWIB, the MyPath, MyPathsCareer.org or whatever it is called. That may be a piece, but it's only a small piece of the question of connecting students to the idea of the broad array of jobs out there. We have a particularly challenging time in the manufacturing area because of all the headlines about manufacturing being dead or manufacturing consisting of nothing but dead-end jobs. Now, I've already commented on the fallacy of the dead-end job theory in because of what you can earn as a production employee in manufacturing. But we need to do more than just have a website for youth to overcome the perception that there is no reason to consider manufacturing as a career. We need to improve our connections at the high school level between businesses and the schools. We need to improve our direct communication, not only with students, but with the teachers, with the counselors in the schools, and more importantly, with the parents. I was at the Portland Business Alliance board retreat a couple of weekends ago, and I was talking about the Northwest Youth Career Expo, which annually introduces almost 5,000 students across the state and Southwest Washington to an array of jobs that are available to them if they are not interested or not able to get a college degree. And one of the participants, one of the board members, came up to me afterwards, is a vice president in one of the major banks, and he said he had no idea, and it was of extreme interest to him because his son is not going to be able to go to college. Not for financial reasons, but for academic reasons. And he was despairing over whether or not there could be a good career path available in this state for his son. And I said, absolutely, get him to the expo. But we need more of those kinds of efforts. We need more of the direct connection between business and the students and their parents, to introduce them to the broad array of employment opportunities that are available in this state. The other area where we still have a disconnect is in the training resources. Okay. Yes, there have been some improvements, but in my company, the average age of our millwrights is 54. It takes years to become a certified, qualified millwright. There are no apprenticeship programs in this state for millwrights. We are now bringing in two high school students in collaboration with the Portland Workforce Alliance and Portland Public Schools to start training them in how to be millwrights. They will work for us for 500 hours a year under very close supervision, and we will start to develop our own apprenticeship program for millwrights because there is no other resource available for us, and we're not the only ones. I know of one company that went to the Oregon State Penitentiary to recruit their next millwright, because someone who was about to be released had those skills.
I'm going to have to interrupt.
I'm finishing.
Okay.
Yeah, we can't find NDT specialists anywhere in this state. My last comment is just that where I am in violent agreement with Mr. Sager's comments is over the value of the career readiness certificate, and I would urge this committee to incorporate that concept into this bill. I think it is a huge step forward for us in this state. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Any quick comments or questions? I'm not seeing any. With that, I am going to carry the hearing on House Bill 2398 over to Tuesday, February 17th. And I thank everyone who turned out today for this hearing, and apologize to those of you who will, if you want to testify, come back on Tuesday.
Thank
you very much. Kevin, Tuesday we're going to carry the bill over, and what else do we have?
Tuesday we are carrying the bill over to finish comments, as well as ACES will be giving a presentation. They're actually, I understand, going to have a couple of their student participants coming up as well. So we'll get to actually hear from them. So,
and with that, we stand adjourned until Tuesday. Thank you very much.
People are going to think I'm shopping.